From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at NPR West in Culver City, California today. It's Here and Now. Vice President Mike Pence made a surprise visit today to the demilitarized zone that separates South and North Korea. Pence was briefed a few yards from the demarcation line as two North Korean soldiers watched from a short distance away, one of them taking multiple photographs of the unannounced visitor. Pence arrived in South Korea just after the North's failed ballistic missile test launch, and today Pence said this.
Over the past 18 months, North Korea has conducted two unlawful nuclear tests and an unprecedented number of ballistic missile tests, even conducting a failed missile launch as I traveled here for this visit. The era of strategic patience is over.
Joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Jeremy.
And this visit to South Korea comes at a very tense time in the region with a lot of heated rhetoric from the North and from the Trump administration. Pence also said that North Korea would do well not to test President Trump's resolve, referring to the strikes on Syria and Afghanistan. Where's this headed?
Curious, isn't it, to think how close the warring sides are to each other? Vice President Pence was so close to the North Koreans today, he almost could have posed with selfies with some of them. But really, you know, the United States is not the ultimate player or actor in the Korean Peninsula crisis. It's really much more about the two Koreas, much more about Japan and China. And they are going to be the principal actors. No matter how much rhetoric North Korea may direct our way, this is really not about us. And we do tend to see it through our own eyes and through our own leaders. But this is about working it out between those four powers in that very tightly constricted area. A lot of nuclear weapons there. There are missiles. They need to work it out.
But it does feel right now like it's more tense, or to you, does it just seem like normal course of business with North Korea?
It's mostly being driven to the brink by North Korea's leadership. The country is in crisis. The country is in a form of collapse. They are fearful that the South Koreans might choose this moment to try to invade and solve the matter of the two Koreas. That could lead to a very tense situation with both China and the United States involved. We have 30,000 troops in South Korea. We would clearly be involved if that were to happen.
Another big foreign policy story over the weekend, Ron, the results are in from the Turkish referendum, which gives President Recep Tayyip Erdogan much more power. They're eliminating the role of prime minister, and he can stay president until 2029 now. How's the White House responding?
So he's been there 15 years, and he wants possibly another 12. Begins to sound a little bit like president for life, doesn't it?
Right.
The White House obviously has to be troubled by this kind of a development. But on the other hand, there seems to be a general, almost worldwide trend toward more autocratic regimes, people turning to a strong leader in a time of uncertainty or instability, or perceived decline. That seems to be affecting primarily the rural areas of Turkey, which are voting for Erdogan much more so than the cities. He lost all eight of the most populous centers in Turkey and yet won the election barely.
So that city-rural divide also being seen in Turkey. One other thing, Ron, there's actually an election in this country tomorrow. Voters in Georgia's 6th congressional district are going to be voting for a congressional seat that was vacated by Tom Price, who became the Health and Human Services Secretary. Now, the Democrat in the race is John Ossoff, and he is currently leading in this 18-person race in Georgia. Here he is talking to MSNBC last week about why Trump underperformed in the district relative to how he did in the rest of the state.
This community where I grew up is a moderate, pragmatic district, economically minded. I think it recognizes that extremism is bad for business. It wants effective, principled leadership. Doesn't identify as particularly partisan or ideological. I think that's one of the reasons the president had some difficulty here.
Now, Democrats lost a similar special election last week in Kansas. Do they have a chance here, and what does it mean?
They do have a chance here. It's a much better district for them than the one in Kansas, where the Republican winner, Ron Estes, ran 20 points behind what Donald Trump did in that district in November. If we saw anything like that in the Georgia 6th, there would be a Democrat in that seat, at least temporarily. But let's bear in mind, this is Tom Price's district, and he is by no one's measure a moderate. He is definitely a very strong partisan Republican, very much an ideological conservative. So that's his district. It's been his district. He's been popular there. I don't think people should draw too much of a conclusion about that 20 points.
That's NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Your taxes are due tomorrow, and while you may be scrambling to finish your return, let's talk about where that money is actually going. Daniel Klein is a contributing writer at The Motley Fool. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. Maybe not so well since taxes are due. But let me ask you, first of all, how much is the average amount of taxes that a household in the U.S. pays?
Well, there's two ways to look at it. If you break it down across everybody, it's a little under $10,000. But if you factor out the lower income people who either pay no taxes or even get a small amount back from the earned income credit, then the people who actually pay taxes, it's around $15,000, which is, you know, a pretty sizable sum.
Okay, so what is happening then with that sizable sum? I mean, what are the biggest chunks of money that those tax dollars go towards?
See, this is where most people sort of get it wrong, because we have all this publicity about budget cuts. You know, we're going to cut 5% from NASA. We're going to cut 3% from, you know, the Clean Air Fund or whatever it's called. And the reality is about 75% of our dollars go to Social Security, Medicare, defense, health. It's really the programs that take care of people plus defense. Everything else is kind of a trivial part of the budget.
So tell us in a little bit more detail then, of that $15,000 that on average households are paying, how much goes towards entitlements?
Well, it's about 75% of it. And the reality is, so when you're paying your taxes, most people, unless you're an independent contractor, don't sit down and write a big check. It's coming out from your paycheck in small little dribs and drabs. And that's probably why we're not thinking about, you know, where is this money going? So, for example, 5% of our social services goes to veterans benefits. And, you know, most people would probably think, okay, that's great. Veterans benefits, I support that. But maybe everyone doesn't support Medicare starting at 67. Maybe some people think, geez, you know, you could work till 70 and Medicare should be pushed back to that. So it's really, you know, your money, the money you're paying in taxes, the biggest chunks of it are going towards your neighbors. It's not even infrastructure. It's just checks being paid out and, of course, defense, which gets about 15%, which is actually historically on the low side of what we've spent for defense.
Mm. You know, it's interesting because a lot of people might rail against the idea of taxes for exactly the reason you're talking about, that the money is going to your neighbors. But you're also someone else's neighbor, by definition. And I'd say that's the cost of having a functioning civilization.
Well, I think what gets lost in the taxes is, you know, so let's say you take a hot button issue. Let's pretend $500 million is going to a program to neuter cats. I'm just making it up completely. And that could get a ton of media attention. Some people believe it shouldn't happen. Some people believe it should. But the reality is that money would be like if you have a mortgage, a car loan, a college loan payment, and you spent 6 months debating with your significant other whether you should get rid of Netflix. And that's kind of how we talk about budgeting. We focus on very tiny things, you know. So, you know, me saying, well, I don't want to pay for new hats for school children or whatever it happens to be, it's really missing the issue that if we want to cut the budget, we have to look at entitlements and social programs. But the reality is all these little cuts do nothing.
Yeah. Well, before we get too far away from the line item spending that these tax dollars are going to, is there a particular line item that you think might surprise us in terms of maybe we're spending more or less on it than we popularly think?
Well, I think it might surprise people to know we're only spending 3% of our budget on education. Mm-hmm. That's a small number. And it might surprise people to know that about a quarter of our budget goes to Social Security. So, yeah. You know, if you're looking at how you can make cuts the fastest, Social Security by almost 10% is ahead of Medicare and defense.
How are are these numbers that you've been crunching about where our tax dollars go? I'm wondering, how are they different than what tax spending has been historically?
They're not all that different. Now, we've seen, defense spending has actually come down as it relates to GDP. Of course, we're about to see it go back up if the current proposed budget goes through. And we've seen a slow rise in Social Security and Medicare, which is because our population is getting older. Those numbers are going to tick up. And we talk about, bankrupting the Social Security fund. And what happens is at some point, the amount of people who are working who fund that fund and the amount of people who are collecting becomes out of balance. But, in general, it's not like we used to spend 10% of our budget on on NASA, and now we only spend 0.25%. These are pretty much how we have been spending it in the modern era.
Mm. Daniel Klein is a writer at The Motley Fool. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Did you get enough sleep last night? Did you toss and turn or lie awake worrying? If you did, you're not alone. 1 in 3 American adults doesn't get enough sleep, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Joining us now is Dr. William Dement, who's an emeritus professor and the founder of the Stanford Center for Sleep Sciences and Medicine. He's known as the father of sleep medicine. Dr. Dement, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And why do so many people complain that they can't sleep?
Well, it is not a single type of complaint. There are many reasons to complain, and the really important thing is to arrive at the correct reason and then do something specific to deal with it.
What are the most common reasons for trouble sleeping?
Well, I think that if you say trouble sleeping, that is not really insomnia. There are many sleep problems, and the most serious problem is called obstructive sleep apnea, where for a variety of reasons, you stop breathing when you fall asleep and you have to wake up to breathe, and your sleep is very disturbed, and then you have sleepiness and drowsiness in the daytime. And I think that evaluating how you function when you're awake is one of the key things, because even if you think you have disturbed sleep or you're not falling asleep quickly enough, if you feel fine and wide awake and alert all day long, forget it. It's not a problem.
How many hours of sleep should you be getting each night? I mean, we hear always, between 6 and 8 hours of sleep, but is that your range?
Well, I think that's a reasonable figure. I think, however, what I advise is every single person should try to determine their own unique sleep requirement. And again, you do that by sleeping a certain amount or being in bed a certain amount of time and then seeing how you function during the day. If you eat lunch and then you can hardly stay awake, there's a problem.
Well, we see somebody like President Trump going to bed clearly pretty late based on his tweets and then waking up pretty early based on his tweets. Is he getting enough sleep in your view?
Well, I'd be a little bit skeptical, but I think you don't really know for sure how much sleep people are getting. They often are not correct in telling you. I might say I sleep 6 hours a night when I really sleep 7, but I don't really keep track of it that closely. And I think that, you can have ups and downs. You can sleep a little less, a little more. You might take a nap. But very few people keep track of it over a sufficiently long period of, large number of days to really pin it down.
What are your thoughts on naps?
I think if you are sleepy and something is coming up that's going to require alert behavior, taking a nap is a good thing. I personally have begun to nap as I've gotten older. I think naps are good.
How long do you nap for?
Oh, and you say an hour, it could be 40 minutes, it could be even a 10-minute nap can revitalize you.
Hmm. Now, I've heard that one of the things that you should not do right before you're trying to go to bed is watch TV or look at a cell phone or something with that kind of light.
Well, if you have a problem falling asleep, that's very important. I wouldn't generalize and say absolutely 100% of individuals must not watch TV, because for some people, TV is kind of the, especially if they have an automatic turnoff, is kind of a something that lulls you to sleep. My own personal system is to pick a radio program that is very, very dull.
Not this one, I hope.
No, this is a very exciting one. But, you know, you kind of, it distracts you from any concern. Well, why aren't I falling asleep? And I think many times people can fall asleep without realizing it and then wake up later and think they've been awake all that time.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Dr. William Dement, who's the founder of the Stanford Center for Sleep Sciences and Medicine. And Dr. Dement, what happens to our brains and our bodies when we sleep?
Well, the body relaxes. There's no question about that. There are two kinds of sleep, which is very important to understand, and they're as different from one another as both are from wakefulness. One state of sleep is called rapid eye movement sleep, or REM sleep, and that's about 25% of the night. And the remainder of sleep, 75% on the average, is simply non-REM sleep. Nightmares tend to occur in REM sleep. Hmm. I mean, they uniquely, I guess. And night terrors that are more typical of young children would occur in non-REM sleep.
And do they tend to mean something? Do you think when somebody has a nightmare or a night terror that there's something deeper behind that?
Sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't, although to say there isn't, you know, is always uncertain. You can't ever be sure. But it's fun to try to interpret your dreams. Whether they have, you know, vitally important meanings or not, I think is still an unresolved issue. And in a certain sense, it's still an unresolved issue. Why do we dream? Well, the easiest reason for that is that during REM sleep, the brain becomes very active, and at the same time, mechanisms unique to REM sleep paralyze the body, so that you in effect, the brain is telling you to run if you're running in a dream, but your body is paralyzed and cannot move. And the muscle that is not paralyzed, thank goodness, is the diaphragm, so obviously you continue breathing, and the intrinsic eye muscles. So you can have these rapid eye movements, which I think, and I think it's still a little controversial, but I think that some of the eye movements are clearly looking at the dream. We once had woke someone whose eyes were moving back and forth very regularly. He was dreaming of watching a tennis match, and we actually took him out to watch honest-to-God match and got the same eye movement pattern.
Hmm. Interesting. So is it possible to catch up on sleep? If you get only 4 or 5 hours of sleep one night, can you make up for that by sleeping 10 hours the next day and all is well?
Well, you certainly can catch up on sleep. You don't have to do it minute for minute.
Do you think it's a good idea for people to take medicine if they can't sleep?
Well, certainly in the short term, if it's really a crisis, I think that sleeping pills have kind of got a bad rap. Today's sleeping pills are very safe, very effective. And if there's really a need to get, you know, decent sleep because of some crisis in your life, I would certainly not suffer insomnia as opposed to taking a currently available sleeping medication.
What about something like melatonin? A lot of people say, oh, take melatonin if you can't sleep.
Well, we've actually studied it, and it works for some, and it doesn't work for others. The one advantage it has is you don't need a prescription.
Now, you have mentioned a number of times in this interview about sort of traumatic life experiences connected to sleep. Is that typically the reason why somebody can't sleep, is because something bad has happened?
If something bad happens, it has often disturbed sleep. It's hard to know just how much stress it takes. Some people can sleep through anything. Other people, the slightest upset in their lives, and they'll go to bed and start to worry. One kind of clever little approach to that that I always admired was to schedule a specific worry time. You know, like around 6 p.m., you have to spend 1 hour worrying about all of the problems you have in your life, and then do not worry, if you can actually force yourself, when you go to bed.
I talked to somebody recently who did exactly that. Schedule the worry time. And what she said was, of course, you go to your worry time and then you don't worry about anything because you get bored after a minute of worrying.
That's right. The worries aren't as bad as you thought. I will say everything looks worse at night.
So you've been studying sleep for a long time. Has the science of sleep evolved a lot in the 50-some years you've been looking into it?
Well, I would yes. If you take the whole 50 years, it's evolved tremendously. In 1970, there were no sleep clinics in the United States, and as far as I know, anywhere in the world. We opened the world's first sleep disorders clinic here at Stanford in the summer of 1970. Now there are sleep clinics are everywhere, and I think in general, if sleep and falling asleep and getting enough sleep is appears to be a serious problem, the correct thing to do is to go to a sleep disorders clinic.
That's Dr. William Dement, who is an emeritus professor and the founder of the Stanford Center for Sleep Sciences and Medicine. Dr. Dement, thank you.
You're very welcome.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
A multi-state manhunt is underway for a suspect who allegedly shot and killed an elderly man in Cleveland yesterday and then posted a video of the incident to Facebook. Police say the man is considered armed and dangerous. Nick Castell is a reporter for WCPN Ideas Stream in Cleveland, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network. And Nick, first of all, tell us what happens in that video that was posted to Facebook.
Well, I haven't seen the video itself. It was removed, I believe, by the time I was following this story. But my understanding is this video shows an individual shooting an elderly man who has since been identified as Robert Godwin Sr., a 74-year-old man. Police have identified the suspect as someone named Steve Stevens. This person also posted a video on Facebook in which he claimed to have committed other homicides. Now, police have said that they have searched high and low. They have not found evidence that anyone else was a victim besides this one person who's been identified.
Okay. Now, as you mentioned, that video has been taken down or was taken down relatively quickly by Facebook. But just to clarify, originally reporting had come out that the video may have been posted via Facebook Live, but that's not the case. It was uploaded, right?
Correct. That's what Facebook is saying now, that this video was recorded first and then uploaded. But initially, there was some belief that it might have been streamed live. And that's what police were saying initially as well. But Facebook sort of batted down those suggestions last night.
Okay, so that's what Facebook is saying. All right. Now, in a press conference this morning, Cleveland Police Chief Calvin Williams seemed to debunk some rumors that authorities had traced the suspect's cell phone to Pennsylvania. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, you know, the police chief was asked about this idea that I believe had been reported by some other news outlets that they had received pings of his cell phone in Erie, Pennsylvania. The police chief, he didn't confirm or deny those rumors. He just said, I can't really tell you anything about that right now. What police have said is that they don't know where this individual, Steve Stevens, is right now. They have been asking him to turn himself in. Police even said that they did early in this investigation investigation have contact with him on his cell phone. Didn't really go into detail about what was discussed or how or when this conversation happened. But since then, they said they have not had contact with him and they don't know where he is, and they're asking him to turn himself in.
Huh. Now, what advice then are law enforcement officials giving to the public?
Well, they said that this suspect, they believe, was driving a white Ford Fusion with a temporary tag. They're asking people to be on the lookout for him, and not just in Ohio, but also in surrounding states, Pennsylvania, Indiana, Michigan, as well as New York. This manhunt seems to involve a number of states. They're asking people to look out. They'll be putting up, I believe, billboards or information near highways and roads to sort of give people information to know what to look for.
And Nick, in the last couple seconds that we have, the chief also had a message from the family of victim Robert Godwin Jr. What was that?
Right. Well, the chief said that a number of GoFundMe accounts had been set up in the name of the family, the Godwin family, saying they were raising money for Robert Godwin. What the chief said was that these online fundraising campaigns were not connected to the family. They were not authorized by the family, and they had just no connection to them.
Nick Castell is a reporter for WCPN IdeaStream in Cleveland, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network. Nick, thank you so very much. 7 years ago this week, the Deepwater Horizon oil well drilling platform exploded, killing 11 workers and causing the largest marine oil spill in U.S. history. More than 130 million gallons of oil gushed into the Gulf of Mexico, and by the time the well was capped almost 3 months later, entire ecosystems had been damaged, some irreparably. Scientists are still investigating the impact of the spill. At the Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota, Florida, 20 miles inland from the coast, researchers are growing adult fish in huge tanks and slowly exposing them to oil. As David Levin reports, they're hoping their experiment will show how various species are affected by oil both in the short and long terms and which species could be at risk.
Driving east of Sarasota, Florida, the landscape changes fast. Strip malls and office parks give way to quiet farmland and live oak trees dripping in Spanish moss. But crops aren't the only thing growing out here. In a small cluster of buildings tucked along a gravel path, a team of scientists is raising thousands of fish.
Hey, Kevin.
How are you?
All right.
We're getting going. We have a hectic start, but we're getting there.
So what's first?
You will see. We'll get you indoctrinated in here.
Kevin Main is the director here at the Moat Aquaculture Park. It's both a commercial fish farm and a research lab, a jumble of pipes and tanks tucked into long aluminum-sided buildings. Normally, Maine looks into new ways to raise fish for food, but today she's helping figure out how an oil spill might affect adult fish in the wild. After the Deepwater Horizon spill in 2010, many fisheries across the Gulf were closed for months, but it's not clear if that oil had a long-term impact on the species living there. And that's what Maine and her team are hoping to find out.
We can go out and test animals and determine that they're safe to consume. And that gives you one piece of information that allows you to reopen a fishery. But what we don't know is what is the effect on the next generation? And what are the long-term impacts that will affect the breeding of those animals off into the future?
Studying how oil affects the way fish breed is a challenge. Only adult fish can reproduce, and a lot of important commercial species in the Gulf are huge when they're fully grown. Just two or three fish would take up a tank the size of an oil drum, so growing them in most labs, which have limited space, isn't really feasible. Here at Moat, though, it's a different story.
So it all starts here with the breeding systems.
Maine leads me to a tank that looks like an above-ground swimming pool. Inside, gigantic fish are circling slowly.
And so these are adult red drum. They're huge, aren't they?
They're almost, 3 feet long, 4 feet long?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. And quite a good girth on them. I mean, look at some of those girls there.
Yeah. Maine is raising hundreds of fish like these from three different species, pompano, flounder, and red drum, which is also called redfish.
And the reason we wanted those three species is they not only represent important recreational and commercial fisheries, but they also represent three potentially different types of exposure scenarios that could have happened.
This is Dana Wetzel, a marine biochemist leading the research. She says the three fish live in three different environments, and each one is affected differently by a spill. Pompano, for example, live in open water, so they're mostly exposed to oil droplets under the surface. Then there's redfish.
And the redfish is a more coastal fish.
So in a spill, they're hit with contaminated water and contaminated food.
Because the redfish are going to be picking and feeding along the contaminated shoreline sites.
And finally, there's flounder. They spend most of their time in silty bays.
They live in the sediments.
Which means they're exposed to oily water, food, and mud after a spill. Wetzel is planning to recreate all three settings here at Moat and put each one through a simulated oil spill. The goal is to get a better understanding of what the oil really does to those species in the wild, and whether its effects stick around long after a spill is cleaned up.
Of those that survived, are they perfectly happy and normal? I don't know about that. Because right now it's the adults that are, you know, in charge of reproduction. So if we are impairing adults, maybe we're impairing them for one season. Maybe we're impairing them for life. We don't know this.
To find out, Wetzel and Maine are systematically exposing the fish, a few at a time, to oil. In 9 small tanks, pompano are put into oily water. Redfish are fed oily food. And eventually, flounder will go into oily sediments. The group can only work with a few fish at a time. And today, it's redfish. That means South Louisiana sweet crude is on the lunch menu. In a back room, biologist Matt Resley whips up a new batch of food in a disposable metal pan. It's a pile of smooth brown pellets, each about the size of a pea, and they're coated with a thin sheen of oil.
After we've top-coated everything, it is a little bit darker, but you can see it's pretty porous.
Oh, it looks like my cat's food.
It basically is. Purina actually makes fish food.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's all made the exact same way.
Resley has been feeding this stuff to this group of pompano for more than 2 weeks, and today's the last day the fish will have to eat it. Now the Moat team needs to determine if the oil had any effects on the fish. And there's only one way to do that. They'll need to euthanize them with a heavy sedative, dissect them, and send their body parts to the lab. A bunch of labs, really. Scientists around the country are partnering with Moat on the study, and each one needs a few tissue samples.
All right. Next up on our hit parade is removing its internal organs. See all this white material right here, right under the skin?
Yeah.
That's fat. That's a fat little guy.
Dana Wetzel and a few biologists are already working on the latest batch.
Right now I'm dissecting out heart muscle tissue, and that along with some other tissues are going to be sent to our colleagues down at Texas A&M University.
So how many different people do you have with a steak in this fish?
I would say a dozen people at least are working on this one particular fish right here.
Some will look at bile samples to see if oil compromised its immune system. Others will test its blood for toxins or comb through samples of its liver, kidneys, gills, muscle, reproductive organs, even microbes living on its skin. All the pieces of these deconstructed fish go into hundreds of tiny glass jars and eventually into the mail.
So, as you can see, this fish has contributed a lot to science.
Over the next year, the Moat team will repeat this process with hundreds more fish, spanning multiple generations. The team is already seeing that fish exposed to oil aren't reproducing as well as fish kept in clean water. But right now, they can't say for sure if that's due to the oil or if it's just a fluke, so to speak.
95% of all commercial and recreational marine species spend part of their life in the Gulf of Mexico. It is such an important area. This information should be able to help decision makers, managers decide, you know, how long should we close an area? What sort of mitigation strategies should we attempt to do? Unless you have the information to know how you may have damaged these organisms and for how long, you know, you can't make those informed decisions.
Regardless of how the study turns out, Wetzel says that understanding what happens to fish during an oil spill is essential for knowing how to respond to disasters like Deepwater Horizon in the future.
That's David Levin. His report was made possible by the Sea Image Consortium. Other animal news. More than a million people watched April the giraffe deliver her baby calf on Saturday morning. The male calf is being described as strong and independent. Jordan Patch, who owns the Animal Adventure Park in upstate New York, says the baby is still unnamed and that it was on its feet within an hour of its birth. And within 3 hours, the little one was galloping around mom. The zoo began live streaming from April's enclosure back in February. And with a giant Easter bunny looking on, President Donald Trump and his family presided over the annual White House Easter egg roll this morning.
I want to thank everybody. This is the 139th Easter egg roll. Think of it, 139. It began a long time ago, 1878. And we will be stronger and bigger and better as a nation than ever before. We're right on track. You see what's happening, and we are right on track. So thank you, everybody, for being here.
The Easter egg roll is a big social event for the White House, but this year's is a bit smaller than in years past. The White House expected more than 21,000 children and adults to attend the egg roll. 35,000 people attended last year. And President Trump's pick to the Supreme Court starts his new job today. Just a week after being sworn in, Justice Neil Gorsuch took the bench today and heard arguments in the nation's highest court. NPR's Nina Totenberg will have the latest on All Things Considered.
We've talked about Tesla, which recently surpassed Ford and even General Motors in terms of market value. There are many who believe that valuation is undeserved, especially given that Tesla is losing money. But Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, believes Tesla can tell us a lot about the future of driving in America. He joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
So Tesla stock is doing very well. It's grown 40% this year ahead of its highly anticipated Model 3 launch. But it sold as many cars in all of last year as GM sells in 3 days. So what are investors seeing here with Tesla?
Yeah, and one more statistic to drive home what some people see as the lunacy of Tesla stock valuation. Tesla lost $800 million last year. Ford made $11 billion. So what exactly is going on? Well, here are a handful of theories. Theory number one is it's not about Tesla. It's really about Elon Musk. He's a genius. He'll figure something out. He's the next Steve Jobs. And you have a lot of investors thinking how great it would be to have thrown their lot in with Jobs in, say, 2002. The second theory is maybe it's not just about the car. It's about the battery. Tesla's Gigafactory in Nevada could be the world's premier manufacturer of lithium-ion batteries, which are used in everything from little phones to big spacecraft. And then theory number three is it's not about Tesla the company so much as it's about the market. There aren't any other surprising, interesting, big risk, big picture public companies in tech right now. So if you're an investor who wants to devote a bit of his or her fund or investments in a great story that could turn out to be the next Apple, Tesla might be number one on that list.
Well, and let's dissect the product a little bit and look at some of the things that make a Tesla a Tesla. Number one, they're electric. Is electric the future of cars, do we think, at this point?
It could very well be. Almost all of the major car companies right now are at least dabbling in electric. General Motors, Chevrolet, Volt, sales are up 40% so far this year. That is the best-selling non-Tesla car, as far as I can see. But right now, electric vehicles also benefit from massive government subsidies. For every electric car sold today, Washington kicks in several thousand dollars in a tax credit. Some states offer even more. And because these cars are really expensive now, that means that you essentially have a really regressive subsidy. That is to say, you essentially have governments paying really rich people thousands of dollars to buy cars that cost $100,000 or cars that cost a lot more than others. So yes, electric could very well be the future of this enormous market. But right now, it is relatively small, I think only about 1% of the market, and its growth is very subsidized by both federal and state governments.
Tesla also has a goal of making self-driving cars. Where do they stand, or what company is ahead in the race to build self-driving cars?
Yeah. I mean, every car company, again, is trying to build a self-driving car. Every car company is. Google is. Uber is. And so, once again, I want to pull back and say, as much as investors want Tesla to be the next Apple, and look, it could be. I can't see the future. But when Apple came out with a smartphone in 2007, there were a lot of companies and competitors like Microsoft that thought that the iPhone was a ridiculous product, that they completely dismissed it. But almost every major car company is trying to make self-driving cars and electric cars. There was a Navigant research paper earlier this year that declared the worldwide leader in self-driving tech is Ford. Then followed by GM and companies like Daimler and Volkswagen. Those are car companies. Right. So it's still plausible to think that the leaders in self-driving tech aren't the tech companies that we hear about, the Google and the Teslas, but that the leaders might be, you know, Toyota and Ford themselves.
Now, you point out a third category that I think we should get into, which is the future of driving going to be private or shared? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so private is what we have now, right? Someone buys a car for themselves. They keep it in their own garage. They drive their own kids around in it. That's private owned cars. But it seems to me that if the future of cars is going to be self-driven, and we've seen that networks like Uber and Lyft can coordinate cars across an urban area, it's possible that the future of cars might be self-driven and publicly owned. That is, for example, urban residents paying for a municipal fleet of autonomous vehicles or paying a single corporation like Uber or Lyft to essentially operate a fleet of self-driving cars that they, if they want a car, they simply press a button and it drives right up to them. And they think to themselves, wait, why own a self-driving car when I can benefit from a network of self-driving cars that's already flowing around these streets? One can easily see how this sort of networked, publicly shared car system could be better for riders, for congestion, for cities, for the environment, certainly. But it will require the sort of coordination around cars and a shift in values among car owners that we just don't see right now.
So shared electric cars that are self-driving, it seems a bit of a long way off from the Jetsons model of the car of the future, but we'll have to see what plays out. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.